material by material things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there are lots of limitations in our material and physical aspect of our existence, aspect of our knowledge. That's why our knowledge is very much limited in terms of physical knowledge, or let's say sensory knowledge.
Yes.
Sensory knowledge has no access to that immaterial things.
Yes.
That's why the moment you try to define something which is not physical by physical means,
mm-hmm.
it becomes problematic.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
Let me give you this example that, for example, in your dream,
yes.
you see, for example, something like an animal
mm-hmm.
that you cannot find any similar animal
yes.
in the world.
Yes.
If you want to talk about that animal to the people,
mm-hmm.
how can you explain?
Yes.
Whatever explanation you give to the people, it will be misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
No one can understand exactly what you've seen in your dream. You know, that is totally different. Now, when it comes to the ruh, is also we have the same problem. But of course, it doesn't mean that we cannot understand the existence of ruh. We cannot understand some of the features, characteristics of the ruh. Of course, our philosophers, our theologians, our mufassirin, muhaddisin, they presented some of the, let's say, features, characteristics of ruh in their works. That is very much in detail. We cannot cover all of them.
Yes.
But the main characteristic of ruh is this, that ruh and soul is something immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
It's something non-physical. It is not something like brain.
Yes.
It is not something like mind.
It is not
mind,
a psychological concept.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mind, brain, body, they are different from ruh, from soul.
Even some of the mutakallimin and some of the philosophers of Islam have differentiated between ruh and nafs, okay?
Exactly.
So, yes, yeah. You know, yeah. It is a very much complicated concept.
Yes, of course.
So, for sure, according to Islamic beliefs, ruh is not the mind, is not the mechanism which took place in the brain. It
yeah.
is far, far behind that.
Yeah,
that's
of course,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
That's all right. So they say that in Islam, all the actions and the deeds that we do have a kind of effect on our life. And the most important effects are on the ruh of a person. So how a mujarrad or immaterial thing can absorb the effects of our, for example, physical deeds, Sheikh?
Mm-hmm. You know, from the Islamic perspective, according to the Muslim philosophers, ruh is stronger and more powerful existence as compared to the physical body.
Yes.
Physical body is like a horse.
Yes.
A ruh is like the one who rides the horse and control it. So that, since the existence of soul and ruh is superior, is more perfect, is more, let's say, powerful and strong as compared to the physical body. So that's why ruh can affect let's say, the body.
Yes.
Can control the body, can make use of the body.
Yes.
You know, for example, brain is like an instrument,
mm-hmm.
like a tool for ruh.
Yes.
Ruh perceives something via maghz, what we can say, via brain.
Brain,
in
that's
Farsi,
right.
We say maghz.
Yes.
And so this brain is like an instrument, like an equipment in the hand of soul and ruh. What perceives in reality is ruh, is nafs. According to Muslim philosophers, perceiving or let's say knowledge, the nature of knowledge is also immaterial.
Yes.
Because it is perceived by ruh and nafs. So then the body, all these physical means by which we perceive and we, let's say, understand or realize something,
yes.
They are like means for the nafs, for the soul. So that's why soul and ruh, since it is superior in terms of existence, it is more stronger than body, then it can make use of the body, it can control the body, it can rule over the body.
Allama Sha'rani resembles ruh to the sunlight. It says that when the sunlight is on the wall, if the wall is demolished, still the sunlight is over there.
Of course, yeah.
So ruh to the body is like the sunlight. If the body is rotten and diseased, so again the ruh remains. Why? Because the ruh belongs to a superpower, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So we could see that this immaterial concept of ruh is, we can say it is amr khudai, it is a divine.
Or for example, you can give this example that while you're sleeping, in your dreams, in your dream you perceive, you see, you sense, you talk, you hear. While your eyes are closed, your ears are not working, your tongue does not move. You know, your body is sleeping, nothing working in your body. But still, you sense.
Yes.
Still, you taste something. Still, you feel. Still, you talk.
Yes.
Still, you see.
Yes, yes.
So, if you see only with your eyes, so eyes are closed, how do you see?
Yes.
If you hear only by your ears, then your ears are not working. If you talk only by your tongue is not moving. So what is that is perceiving? What is that is talking? What is that is seeing, that is feeling, you know? That is nafs.
Yes.
That is nafs.
Yes.
Sometimes in dream, we have true dreams as well, you know?
Yes.
That you truly see something and then later you understand that everything was true. So then this is the power of soul, of nafs. And also there are some people that can take their soul out of their body by under their control. So if you could do that, then you would understand that how much stronger is your soul if you can separate your soul from the body.
That's right.
If you have this path.
Even in a hadith by Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, ruh and raih are from the same concept, which means wind. So as if the wind has the power and cannot be seen, ruh has the power but cannot be seen. This is a nice resemblance.
And also in the Holy Quran, we say, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِ.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like blowing.
Blowing.
To the body.
That's right. Blowing, like a wind, which is, or we can say breeze, that is blown. Does the angels have ruh too?
You know, we have different, let's say, levels of ruh. We have, for example, in our philosophers term it as ruh al-nabati. What we can
a
say.
Planetary?
Planetary ruh.
A planetary, yes.
And then we have ruh hayvani.
Animalistic.
Animalistic kind of spirit or
spirit
soul.
Or soul, that's right.
And then we have humanistic kind of ruh. Human ruh.
Insani.
Which is ruh insani. And then after that, we have a higher level of ruh when the ruh of insan, when the ruh of human transcend and perfect, it goes up. You know, that is the higher level of ruh and nafs.
So, do we
sometimes
have any
angels have such a level of ruh, which is more powerful than the normal ruh of the people.
So, so in this way, the angelic ruh cannot be rotten or cannot be, for example,
It's completely immaterial. It's completely immaterial because the existence
cannot be polluted with sin or something
that. No, never, never. It's pure ruh.
Okay.
That also in the Quran, sometimes they are called also ruh.
Yes, yes.
The angels are also
angels
called ruh,
are,
some
ruh,
of them.
That's right.
So this title is used for the angels because of what? Because they are pure ruh, perfect ruh.
Yes.
But we should not forget that sometimes the ruh of human can become more stronger, more powerful, more higher in terms of position and status as compared to the angels.
Yes.
As we have for the ruh of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the event of Mi'raj, his ascension to the heavens, which is mentioned in Surah Al-Asra. In that event, Angel Jibreel or the Archangel accompanied him up to a specific level.
Yes.
And then the Prophet saw the angel that he can no longer follow and accompany him. When he asked the angel, the archangel, that why don't you follow me? Why don't you accompany me anymore?
Yes.
He said that I cannot enter that level that you entered. That is specific for you. So it shows that the human soul can be more, let's say, perfect, more, let's say, it can be higher in terms of status and position, even as compared to the angels.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for your notes. Of course, this is a very complex and complicated topic.
Issue, of course.
You know, it needs lots of discussions. But what is important is that Muslims believe in the concept of ruh, in the concept of the existence of the ruh after the body is deceased and demised. Still, the ruh exists. You know, it enters Jahane Barzakh, intermediate world, or purgatory, or something like that.
Yeah,
over there, it's over there. The effects of our actions on the ruh are clear and authentic according to Islamic beliefs. Thank you very much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you.
You're
welcome. Concept of ruh and what is the definition of ruh according to Islamic beliefs.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Do not forget in your du'as and supplications on the sessions and the majalis that you attend during the holy months of Muharram, during the months of Muharram, especially on the days of Tasua and Ashura. Do not forget to visit our website too at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident, which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago. That doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehrdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the side's joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism. Iran and Syria are two long-time allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the ninth consecutive time, and a tenth increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table, to continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot.
I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day where millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in Turkey to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein.
Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries. But now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists.
In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the holy book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year, mashallah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with African countries when the Grand Deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs, sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang.
The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be dispatched from the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history, as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past 4 decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The US and the EU can't countenance an international order that they don't lead, while Russia and China are striving to build a fair and just order where all countries are equal regardless of their size. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, St. Petersburg hosted the second Russia-Africa summit from July 27th to 28th that was attended by 17 heads of state from that continent. They and other participants, which also included five vice presidents and four heads of government alongside many national delegations, bravely defied Western pressure to come to this event. Russian officials earlier claimed that the US and the EU were trying to talk their guests out of going. This allegation was lent credence by the publication of hostile Western media editorials. The overwhelming majority of African countries participated in some capacity after only five countries declined to send representatives to the summit. Western political and media pressure failed to ruin the event because African countries appreciate the ways in which Russia can help them strengthen their sovereignty during these unpredictable times. The West anti-Russian sanctions that were imposed after the start of its special operation in Ukraine caused problems for its African partners, which weren't resolved in spite of the Black Sea Grain Initiative that Moscow recently declined to extend after it accused the West of not fulfilling its part of the deal. Nevertheless, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised during the latest summit to ship the neediest of them grain free of charge by year's end. This brings the analysis around to discussing other aspects of the event, since it concerned more than just strengthening Russian-African agricultural cooperation. Consistent with the theme of peace, security, and development, military ties were discussed bilaterally with interested countries behind closed doors, but the details weren't publicly disclosed due to their sensitivity. Additionally, academic, energy, financial, industrial, institutional, media, and other forms of cooperation were also discussed. What connects everything together is that the comprehensive expansion of Russian-African relations in each of these spheres advances President Putin's vision of helping his country's partners on the continent strengthen national and cultural sovereignty, like he pledged to do leading up to the summit. He is regularly spoken about this concept since the start of the special operation, which he considers to be the prerequisite for mutually beneficial partnerships. It deserves to be mentioned at this point that not a single African country jumped on the West anti-Russian sanctions bandwagon despite immense pressure to do so. This includes those who voted against it at least once at the UNGA. Never before had all of Africa come together like this. Its countries clearly wanted to show the international community that they are truly independent and will no longer let their former colonizers dictate their policies. The West was shocked by this unprecedented display of sovereignty, which is why its officials and media began waging an information warfare campaign against Russia in a desperate attempt to convince African countries to sanction it. Examples include false claims that its military advisors are responsible for atrocities and lying that Russia is weaponizing famine in Africa. No African country was swayed into sanctioning Russia, however, not even those that didn't attend the latest summit. They all know that their objective national interests are best served by keeping their strategic options open and not burning bridges with any of their partners, no matter the external pressure put upon them. Russia is regarded as a historically reliable partner with whom ties can be expanded in whatever sphere any given African country wants, which can help diversify from their previously disproportionate dependence on the West, while complementing their efforts to cultivate even closer ties with China. Russia doesn't attach strings to its agricultural and military aid, nor does China attach any to its infrastructure investments and market access, with these forms of cooperation combining to strengthen African state sovereignty. Moreover, these major countries are also sincere in their desire to improve people-to-people ties, especially academic exchanges and skills training. The reason for this is that they envisage Africa as a whole functioning as an independent pole in the emerging multipolar world order. Therein lies the primary difference between the US and the EU on one hand and Russia and China on the other. The first pair attaches the strings of some sort of all forms of aid in order to keep Africa subordinated to them, while the second pair never attaches any of the aforesaid since it wants to empower Africa's rise. This insight enables one to better understand the significance of the second Russia-Africa summit, which is intended to function as Russia's complementary version of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Both events take place at multi-year intervals, thus providing enough time to make progress on their action plans. Although Russia is comparatively late in re-engaging with Africa, it more than makes up for this delay with the strategic role that it plays in ensuring its partners' agricultural and military needs.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back. This is Youth Station. I'm Asma.
And I'm Bita, back again.
Yes, you're listening to IRAB English Radio. And there again, we have another story to tell.
As a thing that I know, you are really interested in the battlefield of happiness and sadness and so on. Yeah
heroic
and,
stories.
Yeah, exactly. And dramatic stories. And you are always the supporter of the sad side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, I think...
And I'm not alone in that boat. You accompany me.
Yeah, exactly. And always you're here talking about these things. Like, we're so excited. And then how come, like, we're talking about some dark thing?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think as human beings... we feel more connection and correlation with sadness. There is more depth into that than happiness, you know. I think there are some group of people who just tell that, okay, when there is no sadness, you cannot understand the meaning of happiness. I do not agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think sadness is sadness, happiness is happiness.
Beta, you see, yeah. Even in human beings, those very happy people yeah. are not attractive people to me.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah,
I know you are always attracted to those miserable creatures
no.
or alone.
Oh my, now don't listen to her, guys.
No,
she
listen
is not
to
introducing me.
Very
well. Well, I have to just say something and support myself.
She's into a miserable person.
No, not miserable people.
Yeah,
people with the stories. I sometimes feel, I was just talking about this thing with my brother. I was telling him that happy people most probably do not have too many stories to tell. Or their stories are just too happy and too not interesting to me.
Too pink and flowery.
Mommy,
and
yes,
a rainbow.
Exactly. Too like, much of that pinkish side of stories is not the thing that I would favor too much. And it's of course, the thing that is the main idea. The main idea is that it is not the reality.
Exactly. You know,
the reality has got some flavor of sadness with it. Because
Which
we're human beings with feelings, and God feelings most of the times are prone into sadness.
I think, when you get this reality of life that you are alone in mm-hmm. every stage of your life, no matter who you are with or, I don't know, no matter how many people you have in your life.
No matter how many people you have,
exactly.
no matter how much money
you have,
no
you
matter
feel lonely.
Nothing, even if you are the king of the world.
Exactly. And this feeling of loneliness is actually directly connected to being
sadness.
Sad.
The thing with sadness and happiness is how long they're going to stay in you.
This is a really nice question that we had a little argument in last episode about it.
Yeah.
And, I think we're more attached to sadness. As I told you, we just embrace this sadness and sorrow that we have about our life.
Because sorrows have got this stronger sort of a core, I guess.
They are. You know, but sometimes we are so much connected to them that we cannot just squeeze them. It's like an addiction. You're addicted to sadness.
I think it's because we learn from our sadness. Happiness is not going to teach you many things, but sadness teaches you many things. Sadness will bring out the version of you that you have never known.
It makes you stronger.
It makes you stronger.
In some sense. And so I'm not really happy to tell you that.
And
I'm
what doesn't kill you,
short
that,
break,
you know,
not
that
Nietzsche.
That code that says what doesn't kill you will make you stronger.
But I heard a new version of that code. Mm-hmm. What doesn't kill you makes you more somber. Somber means so sadder and darker. And
True.
So let's go for a short break. Thank you. For a short break is our blessing here in the station, which is impossible.
You just said something that was nice.
Yeah.
What doesn't kill you only makes you sadder.
Yeah. I read this interesting thing that sometimes you are really attached to your sadness about losing something and being, I don't know, so sad that that thing is not next to you anymore because this is the only thing that is left from that person. It was really interesting for me to see sadness in this way. That's,
you know, in theater, we have this mask of the person who laughs and beside it, the person who cries.
The symbol.
So life is a combination of both the sadness and the
happiness.
And the thing is that most of the time, the image of the people that you see around yourself with a smile on their face, like the thing that we saw in the movie of Joker, like the image of that person, is the fact that it is fake. All those laughs, you're going to hide your sadness, Behind a beautiful smile, behind a cheerful eye, there's some people. When you look at them, when you look at their eyes, you see an ocean of happiness. But then if you dig a little bit deeper, if you get to know them more, if you look at them very much carefully, you could see that just at the very center of their eyes, there is something that tells you about too much of sadness.
You know, actually, I know a lot of people like that, that they are so cheerful, happy.
Exactly.
They are always laughing, joking. And I'm always attracted to these people who joke a lot.
Exactly.
And they have a special sense
of humor. But you know
that
psychologically speaking, those who laugh more are hiding something
exactly.
so sad inside of them.
And the rate of suicide in jokers and
comedians, people who go for comedy,
are so much more than normal people.
Exactly.
It is really interesting that they are, I don't know, hiding behind happiness.
I have this aunt of mine.
Yeah.
She is so strong. She has gone through too much of problems in her life.
Yeah.
Of course, her story ends well. But the thing about her that I wanted to mention is the fact that though she had too much of problems, we didn't get to know them until after 20 years. Now she's just telling us about the problems that she has gone through far away from her family. So she always is the kind of person who never nags. She always smiles. She tells beautiful stories. She makes you laugh. And when you're around her, you do not feel that life is a miserable thing that you're going through. She's so chirpy, so happy. But she just seems so. The thing is that if you stay up at night when she starts to tell her story, when her true self, when her true soul comes out to tell the stories, you could listen to the saddest dramatic stories ever.
This is really nice. I like these people, you know.
Yeah.
It's somehow...
I love them.
Yeah. They are so attractive,
exactly,
the way
yeah.
they see, you know, their world. They're so deep, you know, and they think a lot. They tasted a lot, they experienced a lot. And there is a lot to learn from these kind of people.
Exactly.
I like them. And, you know, there are, I think, two groups of happy people.
What about going for a break and keeping the audience in this suspense to go to come back and then listen to the end?
I'm sad, but I try to pretend to be happy for going to a short break.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
So I was talking about two groups of happy people.
Yeah.
The first one are just some fake happy people who hide their sadness behind
I'm not going to let you say about the second people.
Yeah.
Okay, this is Youth Station.
Thank you. And the second group is actually the first thing that we talked about at the first of the episode.
Exactly.
The people who just, they are happy.
Happy for no reason.
Yeah, exactly.
These, you know,
everything is beautiful. My life is pinkish.
Happy-going people. That, they're clear. Actually, you can differentiate these people from each other. Like even Charlie Chaplin, when you just look at his works, you can understand that, okay, this guy is not this idiotic person who just laughs at everything, who makes you laugh at everything. He's the one who is telling you the saddest thing.
And I think comedy is a form of sadness. I
you know, I sometimes feel even comedy is sadder than tragedy. Because the death of a person who is the main hero of a comedy, if you get to see the death of that person, is even more dramatic than the tragic heroes.
It is. No, I think comedy is so ironic. You know, there is not beautiful irony in every
comedy. It's paradoxical.
It is. And not most of the people can understand that. There are a group of people who just don't get it. They laugh.
Yeah.
The happy, pinkish things that we talk about. There is this group of people who can understand the depth of comedy.
And you know that there are different sort of comedies. As the people that we were talking about, there are different sort of happy people. There are different sort of happy stories.
Exactly.
Some of them have got a meaning behind them and some of them no, really no. It's just like the thing that we see most of the time recently. People try to laugh on just some words.
Yeah.
You know, they are not concepts.
I don't like it.
And I don't like it as well.
It feels empty, you know.
Because this sort of laugh, exactly, these are meaningless.
These are times you're going to just cheat yourself.
Exactly.
I don't like cheating myself. Yeah. You know, it's like, I prefer being sad.
So now two people who are just so interested in literature are talking about sadness and happiness. So we get into literature more and more. But the thing is that we were talking about sadness and happiness in life and how long they would last. And the thing which is very much as a fact, and everybody knows that, is the thing that, you know, none of them are going to last forever. This is the good news and the bad news at the same time.
And the bad news, I think, is that sadness is going to last more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the good news. But then also the bad news is that the happiness is not going to last forever as well. And there is this big chance that happiness lives even shorter than sadness.
I think life would be meaningless if happiness would last forever, you know, till the end of our life here.
Of course, it does not
end forever.
It wasn't
even beautiful.
But it would have some side effects.
It sounds like a cliche. I don't like cliches. And I think these differences and the differences that sadness will make is a blessing itself.
It's a blessing, but you would not understand it at the moment.
Yeah.
At the moment,
at the moment you're fighting,
exactly.
You're struggling with all these obstacles that make you sad. And you know what is really beautiful? That despite the fact that we know sadness is something really essential for our life, we struggle not to be sad. This is
we struggle, and our struggle does not work many times.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess sadness is a sort of a shadow that walks with you through the steps of life.
Yeah.
Happiness is also staying behind the sadness, you know, because we have it in the Holy Book of Quran, "Innama al-usra yusra." That means after each sadness, there is happiness. And it is for sure because God himself is telling us. So there are two things that would chase you throughout your life like shadows. The first one is sadness. The second one is happiness.
They're combined together.
Yeah, they're combined together. There was this quote that I remember I learned it when I was in my high school.
Nice.
The thing that I remember is that I was very young when I learned this.
You are young and now, dear.
From back in time up until now, it just keeps hitting itself in my brain. It said that when you are happy, do not laugh too loud because then sadness would hear that.
Nice.
And when you are so sad, do not kill yourself out of crying because happiness is just lurking around. I guess this is the gist of life. You know, do not... what I'm saying is going to be so painful and very difficult to do. And
reality
maybe myself even am trying so hard to be able to work according to it. But then... it's a fact, and I just keep waiting.
I love facts.
Yeah. Facts that are so painful. So the fact is that when you're so sad, do not overdo the sadness. And when you're so happy, do not do happiness overly, because there's an end to it.
The gist is, don't overreact to emotions.
Exactly.
Emotions is just emotion.
And God has told you the gist and the solution for everything. Innama al-usra yusra. That's the end. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.